Hey, fabulous people, it's Camille Forte here, and I want to thank you for tuning in for the podcast. It is going to be a scorcher. I am hoping to hit some emotional hot buttons today in business. So I have with me on standby with a fire extinguisher in one hand and some kerosene in the other hand, depending on how the conversation goes, the illustrious, the fabulous, the humorous, but the terribly allergy-ridden Michael. And tonight, I really want to take it... What? Not enough applause? What's your problem, huh?
No, you let me say something, you know, humorous. But I have to make a legal disclaimer. As Camille said, that I'm here with an extinguisher and some kerosene. Michael, my entity, does not have any of that thing. So if anything happens on the Camille Forte radio podcast show, I just want the law to know that I had nothing to do with it. And wait. You have to be quiet. Here comes my applause.
Again? Yes. Really?
Yes.
Is it still my podcast? Anyway, all right, business. So let's talk, because this may very well apply to you. I don't think I would have touched on this topic because I didn't think it applied to as many people as I'm finding it does. But last week you heard me do a podcast on social media strategy. And why it's so critical. You've heard me talk about strategy in the past. I had a former boss who just really pounded strategy into our heads, and it's ever since business school, it's really just stuck. But first of all, if you don't have a strategy, whether it's in social media or any other part of your marketing or your business, you will never be able to measure how far you've come, so hence you won't know where you are, and may not know exactly where you're going or if you're where you should be. Now, what happens when you have to change your strategy so much that it questions or it causes you to question your brand identity? And what I mean here is a strategy that actually rocks the four P's. There's product, there's positioning, there's pricing, there's packaging. Those are the four P's in business, right? Well, what happens if, you know, you have to go where your audience goes? You have to go to where your target market goes, and it's the only way to survive. And I'll definitely give some examples, but, you know, there are times when your target audience, your clientele, your customer base makes such a drastic change that you have to, bless you, you have to change your business model in a very significant way, if not altogether, and possibly even change your product. And it may have you questioning your brand identity. And my big message tonight is listen to some of these examples. Listen to, you know, the happy and sad endings, and understand that if you are not getting the results that you so badly desire, it may be time to take a fresh look at your target audience and see what's changed. So I actually want to turn the mic over to the mic and ask him about, anonymously, of course, about a very, very dear friend of his who went through one of the most, I would say, heart-tugging examples of this.
Very much so.
So, we'll take it away, Mike.
Yeah, we'll use his nickname as Chris.
Okay.
And what Chris was, he had a and this is in the Bay Area, of course. You know, and for those that are in the Bay Area that are listening, you'll probably know who this person is because you may have eaten from his food truck. But he is a loving man where he, in San Francisco especially with business, he had a successful restaurant. And with the successful restaurant, he realized, especially where he was in location in San Francisco, that the cost of having a staff, the cost of maintaining permits, marketing, everything was high. But his food quality is phenomenal. People will line up at lunchtime to go to his restaurant and just get his food.
Keep in mind, restaurants are the most, statistically, the riskiest entrepreneurial venture, where only one in 10 restaurants will survive the first year of business.
Yes.
And this guy's restaurant was a huge hit.
Mm-hmm. The first generation here in the States, and he brought his, you know, food from his country, you know, here in the States, and, you know, did really well.
Latin America, if I recall?
It was a fusion between Mexican and Chinese, believe it or not.
Really?
Yes, and people said it didn't work. Wow. It worked. But what it was is that he had a restaurant. He was very thoughtful when he came to his staff, and he paid for their insurance. You know, this is before the whole Obamacare and everything happened, of course, the Affordable Care Act. He paid for cell phone privilege and everything. He wanted to take care of his staff. But as regulations started to get stiffer, permits and so forth got more expensive, marketing, of course, got expensive and everything, he had to face something. And I remember years ago when he said this to me, he's like, Mike, I can't keep the restaurant anymore.
Wasn't it legislative changes?
There were some changes where he had to raise minimum wage. And because of that, he had to lay off a lot of his staff, which he didn't want to do. Mm-hmm. He even said to his staff, look, If I raise your wage, which, you know, I don't have a problem doing, but I'll have to take away cell phone privileges. I'll have to take away your health care. We'll not take it away, but not pay for it as much. Or we mm-hmm. have to find a better plan to pay it off with.
They may have been paid minimum wage, but my gosh, what a package of perks.
And he had like students that, you know, college students that mm-hmm. worked for him at the restaurant. And his turnover rate was very low. I think he had to fire one person in 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody else that would work there, when they were going to school, they would work there. And once they graduated, they stuck around throughout the summer. And then they went and did their internship or did whatever in their respective career. Everyone that knows this person would say that they loved him. But at that point in time, he faced a very difficult decision. He was in red at that point. He was losing money, like he was hemorrhaging.
A law passed where he had to increase that minimum wage, but that ate into his ability to offer them the unlimited Wi-Fi packages.
All the perks that made people happy there.
Right. And these were perks that most employers don't give, you know, to minimum wage employees.
Exactly. And, you know, and what happened was, he said to me one night, he and I were talking, this is when I'm here in New York, and he was saying to me, I don't know what to do. I got to close up shop. He goes, next month will be the last month that we'll be able to operate before I'll have to take another mortgage out on my home, you know, and he was very depressed. And I suggested to him, I said, maybe you need a change of business. Do what you're doing, but maybe at a smaller scale or maybe in another way. He said to me, Mike, you know, you could add the colorful language here. Are you crazy? Blank, 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 blank. And then that night, I always say that he was a guardian angel. He ran into a guy that was trying to get rid of a food truck. He said, hey, I'm on Craigslist. He posted on Craigslist, I have a food truck. It's past all the inspection. Everything's clean on there. You know, I need to get rid of this truck tonight. And out of just jumping without a net, he leaped. And he decided to take the advice of myself and others and open a food truck. So he scaled down his operation from restaurant to food truck.
Not just scaled down, but that was a change. Yes. Of product, of packaging.
Of packaging, product, the way he cooked it, you know, the experience. Pricing. Was when you went to go eat at his establishment, you had the full experience. All of a sudden, this experience became a smaller size experience where it was the same quality of food, but the presentation, everything was much different. Mm-hmm. And he even thought to himself it wasn't going to work. And lo and behold, he was turning a profit of $6,000-$7,000 more per month on his food truck than he was at the restaurant. And
trucks.
Yeah, trucks. He then expanded to 2. And I think right now he's at 8 food trucks right now across the Northern California. And the whole story is that he decided that because his product was that good, but because of the way it was marketed, packaged, distributed, and everything, he went and scaled things down and scaled other things up, but made it more customizable to what it is now. He's successful. I just actually spoke with him today, and he was at the Warriors celebration in Oakland, actually. He said he's making a killing out there today.
That's right. I mean, you have to look at the competitive advantages of the different changes you might make, because he now with the food trucks, he can go to where he knows the customers are.
Exactly. And he was saying to me that we actually talked shop before the podcast, and he was telling me that how he's able to hire the staff back without any problems, still give them the minimum wage that they need, but because it's more portable, he's able to make more of a profit, and he says he's much more happier. The people are happy with his product. He has a higher review on Yelp, and he is able to meet the needs of his customers by taking his product to the customer.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than having them come to a location that was hard for parking, hard to wait in line, limited capacity, now he just goes to the people, and the people just go up to his truck, purchase the food. He sets up tables outside, and, you know, and people are happy, they eat. And he always now uses social media to say, hey, you know, we're going to be here, and we're going to be here from 3 to 5 p.m. or we're going to this festival here, or, you know, at the Coliseum, there's this concert. We're going to be outside the concert on 66th Avenue or somewhere there. And he's getting so much more business. And he's one of those examples, like how Camille's speaking of. You may have, if you're listening right now, and I'm sorry for hijacking this, Camille.
No, I wanted this example. Go ahead.
You may have a great product. You may have a great service. But if you do not learn how to adjust your needs to what your customers' wants are,
Your product,
you are going to be dead in the water.
Yes.
You don't believe me? Go out there and see what your competitors are doing as they are adjusting to where they're answering social media things, people's requests. They're changing their products to, you know, to meet what their customers', you know, desires are.
Well, let's give a couple of other examples, because I think it's the only way to get this point across. And the reason I feel that way is, for those of you who don't know, I went through a very special entrepreneurship program at the University of Arizona while I was getting my MBA, and I remember how one of the biggest lessons that we learned, I mean, even to get into the program, there was one question asked, and I hope I'm not giving away a spoiler for current candidates of the program. You know, what would you do if your business idea simply was not feasible? Simply was not. And one of the reasons I got in was because I was either the only person or one of the only people who said I would thank you, because the program was taught not only by instructors at the university, but by the Desert Angels. And if you know anything about angel investing or venture capitalism, you probably do know or have heard of the angel investors from the Southwest U.S. The old saying goes, you'd give a pint of blood for 5 minutes with the Desert Angels. But the point is, you know, they looked at me and they said, you know, what would you do if we told you that your proposed business model would no way, chance, shape, form, whatever, succeed? And I said, I would thank you. And they seemed very perplexed by that answer. And I said, well, then I waste a lot less time trying to push a boulder uphill. I'm not wasting my time trying to, you know, make a unicorn happen that's not going to happen, and I can either change my proposed business model or I can move on to something else that is feasible. Very happy I got into the program. Many special thanks to Rick Gibson and a lot of other people who took so much time to personally mentor us. But, you know, one of the things that I concentrated on in the entrepreneurship program, which is one of the examples, is, you know, changing in business landscape. Great example. When was the last time you walked into a Tower Records? When was the last time you walked into an FYI?
Ooh, I'm raising my hand on this one. Oh, God. Tower Records 2004, when my daughter was first born, to find Evanescence, you know, live at, you know, Los Angeles. And FYI, Christmas time, because there's one like 20 minutes away, because they had your onesie jumpsuit thing I got you for Christmas. So,
oh gosh, he did get me a onesie for Christmas and I love it. That's so crazy though, because not only, you know, I knew that you were going to say 2004 Tower Records, but I didn't know you were going to mention that band, and that's one of my other examples. So
I didn't look at the notes for the podcast today, so.
Okay, so for those of you who were born before the 90s, you know, there was 8-track, then there was cassette, then there was
CD.
Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry. There was 8-track, then there were records. Mm-hmm. Were records before?
Records, 8-track, yeah, cassettes,
then 8-track,
CD, mini disc, and then MP3.
The point being, they're all gone. Well, except for MP3. Now, records, LPs, vinyl, whatever you want to call it, wax, has made a huge comeback in the collectible niche. Fascinating for somebody like me who's, you know, not only a music lover, but an entrepreneurship and innovation junkie. You know, the fact that they've come back in a collectible way, I think, is amazing. And I actually do have a personal collection of records that may never leave the plastic because they're collectibles and I want them to stay perfect for eternity. But there are no more Tower Records. People, you know, what happened was, you know, do you remember Napster? And there are all the lawsuits about Napster. And then guess what? They found a way to legitimize the digital download industry because they, you know, they, and by they I mean whoever, the powers that be. Just follow along. So,
what Camille's trying to say is, if you look at the music industry 20 years ago, you could walk into Best Buy, and Best Buy had 5 to 10 rows of just music genre. Where if you walk in now, it's just one row. Not even one row, maybe one aisle.
I remember going into Tower Records on South Street in Philadelphia. Mike, it was 3 floors.
Yeah.
3 floors.
They had music, DVD, and then movies, where I remember, and this shows how dated I am, going to Rasputin's in Berkeley in California, mm-hmm. and I was able to find wax, I was able to find cassettes and 8-tracks, and yes, that's how old I am.
Mm-hmm.
But now, unless you go to a specialty store, you're not going to find these places anymore.
But getting back to the podcast, what's the point? Why are we talking about music? Because a lot of big record labels like Sony and Atlantic, Moonshine, their list goes into the hundreds, from major name, you know, household name labels to niche labels. You know, they lived the superstar lifestyle. Their executives were chauffeured to and from the office every day in limousines, and they went out and they found one-hit wonder bands, and they glamorized them, sold the heck out of them, and maybe even threw them away, because when back then, when you bought a tape or a CD or whatever the case was, you had to buy the whole thing. And until Virgin Records came out, you know, Virgin, known for not choosing first mover advantage, for choosing the learning curve. Richard Branson's just genius, I have to say that. Moving on. It was in Virgin Record stores. That was the first time you could hear the music before you bought it. And all of a sudden, record sales started to drop. Because people said, hey, here's this entire CD. I only like the one song that I've been hearing on the radio. It sounds like all the other songs are crap. I'm not going to buy it. And I think this is really what led to the digital downloading thing, because people got fed up with paying for a product that was overpriced, lacking in value. And so there was the whole digital revolution in the music industry. Now, most labels did not hug the curve. They didn't go along with it. And Mike, you mentioned Evanescence.
Mm-hmm.
Wind Up Records, I remember from when I was studying with Rick, because I did a big thing on, you know, the major changes in the music industry and you know, how they either survived or died.
Mm-hmm.
Wind Up Records was one of the only labels that survived, and it was because they took a strategy of not picking one-hit wonders and then, you know, tossing them away when they no longer sold. They took bands and nurtured them. And I remember reading in, it was probably a Harvard Business Review case study, those were like our Bibles, that Evanescence was one of the bands surviving the curve because Wind Up Records was nurturing them.
Mm-hmm.
And now we live in a digital download age, you know, and the music industry did not die. We as humans still have music in every part of the world. We have new artists all the time, but notice everything has changed. The product has changed. The pricing has changed. And the companies that survived are the ones that, whether they liked it or not, were willing to change the product, the pricing, the packaging, the positioning, all the four P's.
To give a quick example, if you look at Apple, when they started to perfect the device that we call an iPod now, of how, okay, you have an iPod, big deal, but Apple said, hey, wait a minute, you guys, you're not seeing record sales because people don't buy singles no more. That, again, shows how outdated are. When people like the favorite song, they go out and buy a single. Now Apple says, how about we create that same single experience by buying a single, but make it digital? And that's how the iTunes store comes. Now, mm-hmm. Anyone that's listening, one time or another, you went to the iTunes store and purchased something, but you heard it before you purchased it. And like how we talk about Virgin, how they did that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you see how everyone evolved, because they realized, wait a minute, people don't listen to the radio anymore. Maybe they do on their way to work or so forth, but we listen to internet radio now, which is limited commercials. Now we have the ability to choose our own favorite groups. I am a personally a Hall & Oates fan and an early 80s kid, so I mm-hmm. listen to 80s music. And that genre changed because people in the companies and the industry, like how Camille talked about the four P's, saw what the demand was of the consumer and said either we could A, still try to push an $18 album where only the artist has one good song, or B, we diversify and put it into a digital streaming package where people would still go buy that same song that they like,
mm-hmm.
but now are more open to buy other songs from that album.
Right. And, you know, if I were to stick to the music topic, I could say that it's had its you know, silver linings in those stormy clouds, because Lord knows it really rocked the industry, no pun intended, and turned it upside down. But also, artists were now more accountable for the quality of their music. They had to put effort into the rest of their tracks.
But it was an evolution of evolving. They went, yes, all of a sudden an artist said, here, I'm going to the studio, busting out 17 tracks, and I'm done. Now they're taking accountability, saying, if I have 16 of those 17 are horrible, I'm going to fail in my sales.
Exactly. And that's the truth. And they know it's the truth. There's transparency now. You know, Isaac Mizrahi in the fashion industry, I'm not going to go into the story, but same thing happened. Consumer Reports came out and said, hey, you know, that designer boutique sweater that you paid $300 for is the same, if not lesser quality, than the identical sweater that you found in JCPenney. And all of a sudden, people stopped shopping in boutique stores, and designers had to change their price point drastically in order to survive. And Isaac Mizrahi, at least according to the research that I read, did not, which is why all of his stores and boutiques shut down, and his house of fashion shut down until he came back with Isaac Mizrahi for Target. If you remember, was that about 10 years ago?
Isaac Mizrahi
hit the scene, and you know, and he made a comeback on Target and QVC, but the point is, it took him a complete shutdown for years in order to bend. Don't be that person.
And that's a lot of revenue you're losing while you're shutting down and restarting. You know, I know we have to wrap this up soon, but you know, guys, I'm speaking for Camille on this portion here. You know, you got to understand something. You may have a great product or service that you offer, and yes, it's probably doing well, but what was the last time you peeked above your monitor and saw what was going on in the real world?
Go back and read my blog about social listening, or listen to the podcast about social listening, because that is one fabulous way to find out what your customers are doing, what they're saying, what they like and what they don't like. And if you are not in touch with that, how can you expect to sell to them? There is one more example that I want to give. There is a photography client I know, and he has had, yes, I know the clock is getting late, but there's a photography client I know of who speaks of his experience with agents. And he talks about how these agents keep pushing him, oh, you know, we see so much potential in you, but if you would only take our acting class for $1,000, you know, we could really get you so much more opportunity. Well, we live in an age of digital learning. There is almost nothing that you can't learn online. I also teach online. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, and the quality of it is not to be sneezed at. Yes, there are a lot of charlatans out there peddling their programs and courses, you know, and whatnot, but there are also some really legitimate ones as well. And I remember talking to him and saying, you know, I saw an ad for an acting class online. It was only about $50, and it was taught by, and I could be getting this wrong, but I think it was, maybe it was Harrison Ford, and there was another one taught by Kevin Spacey. But my point is this. Step back. You may not be a talent agent, but play with me here. Step back. Look at your target audience. Are they going to spend $1,000 with a veritable stranger, take that financial risk, and hope that that class pays off in opportunity, or are you going to sit from the comfort of your home for only $50 and learn from a guy who you know is a household name and has won Oscars or Emmys and all of that? So it may mean taking a $1,000 coaching program or class and turning it into affordable info products. And I know that that can get very emotional, because when you're dealing with businesses, I don't care if they're multinational conglomerates or if they're startups or entrepreneurs, you know, someone in that company has a lot of personal attachment to the brand, the identity, especially if you built it yourself. And my, you know, the biggest thing here of this podcast is keep looking at where your customers are going. Look at where they are compared to 2 years ago, compared to 1 year ago, because things change fast. And if you are still trying to push the same products that you were a couple years ago to the same audience, guess what? They moved. You know, it's like that book, Who Moved My Cheese? Believe it or not, it was actually a good book. Quick read, great lesson. But sometimes your strategy has to change so much that it changes the four P's. And it doesn't mean that you're no longer your brand. It doesn't mean that you're no longer you. It doesn't mean that, you know, your baby is no longer your baby. But it has to change. Mike, anything, you know, any words of comfort for people whose brands might have to overhaul, like your friend?
Only word I could say is that if you're questioning if your brand is suffering or you're falling back, just get a hold of Camille. Just get a hold of Camille and just hashtag her or reach out to her on social media and say, you know, I have a good product. You know, all of us have great products because we feel as such. And but maybe I need an analyst to, I mean, this is not a sales pitch, but maybe I need someone from the outside to look in and tell me what is going right or wrong. There is no shame as a business owner to ask for help.
If anything, there's shame in not asking for help, because then you end up with no business.
Yes. So again, guys, use the hashtag Ask Camille to ask any questions. I know we're kind of running over on this podcast, but you know, this is an important topic. This is something you have to keep in mind. As you know, think of it this way, like I was telling Camille, 9 years ago, social media was still in its infancy. Now everyone uses social media. We go to Facebook before we actually go to the web, you know, and get our 90% of us stay on Facebook throughout the day and get all our news from there, from political news to sports to everything.
We're getting degrees and certifications online. And it's funny, because when you said get in touch with Camille, it never even occurred to me.
10 years ago,
podcast,
it would just be an email or phone call. Now it's on social media.
Right. Or any channel. You know, you have your choice. But it never even occurred to me that a company could easily get through this with like a VIP day. Or a strategy camp, you know? I mean,
you know, again, we haven't set a date on that yet. But, you know, guys, if you're listening to this, it doesn't hurt to just sit over a cup of coffee and just ask Camille straight out, like, okay, I have this product and service. Where can I do better? And, you know, what do I need to do?
It may not be easy at first, but it is possible, you know.
Here, something food for thought. Those that don't swallow their pride don't last enough long enough to swallow water before they die of thirst.
Ah.
Yeah, something
like
to think about.
One. I like that one. Okay, well, thank you. I hope that hit home for some people, and I hope that it gives you hope that you can change your strategy that deeply enough and still keep your brand. So, you know, remember that successory, the bend in the road is not the end of the road unless you fail to make the change. Sometimes it's a hairpin turn.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you everyone for tuning in. Get a hold of me anyway. I'm so easy to find. It's ridiculous. But thank you for tuning in. It's been wonderful. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.